international crisis. We see the humanitarian dialogue, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Preliminary consideration before mediation. Evolution of conflict, complexity, will to resolve. No, I'm not asking, and maybe
you agree with that?
Yeah,
that
okay.
Makes sense.
Okay, and okay, that's it. This is from your guy. He's John.
Yes, John.
Okay, I'll do that and that. So I understand that you can answer questions in French or in English.
Yes.
Okay. It will be at the end of the three presentations.
I know you're like,
that's it. That's it.
The first one?
Okay.
Just in case.
Ouais, je pense que l'idéal, ça va être ça que je vais dire nous.
Ça, c'est vraiment strict.
C'est 2 minutes.
Yeah. Oui, mais on décide qu'on a 2 minutes.
Comment?
Et puis on décide qu'on a 2 minutes. 15 minutes, mais ça se tient.
Ouais, parce que votre collègue va penser.
15 minutes, mais t'as l'air.
C'est beau, oui. On score.
Chers étudiants, ladies and gentlemen, merci de venir comme ça passer une heure et demie en notre compagnie. Mon nom est François Crépeau, je suis le directeur du Centre pour les droits de l'homme et le pluralisme juridique ici à la Faculté de droit de McGill. Nous avons le grand plaisir d'accueillir aujourd'hui des experts dans la médiation de paix. Nous avons reçu la semaine dernière Ban Ki-moon dans les murs de McGill, qui est venu parler à une salle qui était pleine d'étudiants. On était, je ne sais pas combien on était, mais on était 600 ou quelque chose comme ça.
Wow.
C'était bien intéressant. Et McGill a une tradition de travail à l'international. Et certainement, dans cette faculté, ça s'est manifesté depuis de nombreuses années. Les relations avec l'ONU, entre autres, sont importantes. En matière de droits de l'homme, on le sait, mais aussi en matière d'arbitrage commercial. Today we're tackling a different issue. We're tackling the work of the UN standby team of mediation experts, peace mediation we're talking, people being dropped into conflict situations and having to try to make progress between the parties. Je vous remercie d'être venu. Je vais passer immédiatement la parole à Louise Otis qui va modérer le débat. Louise est adjunct professeur dans cette faculté. C'est pour nous, c'est sa principale titre de gloire, son principal titre de gloire. C'est une arbitre en matière commerciale et civile au Canada, mais aussi dans le monde. Elle est Distinguished Fellow of the International Academy of Mediators. She's President of the Administrative Tribunal of the OECD, President of the Appeal Court at the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie. She is a retired justice of the Quebec Court of Appeal, et c'est dans cette fonction à la Cour d'appel qu'elle a introduit la médiation à la Cour d'appel, ce qui a été, je pense, à l'époque, une innovation tout à fait extraordinaire, parce qu'on s'attendait peut-être à de la médiation aux petites créances ou à la Cour du Québec, mais certainement à l'époque, on ne s'attendait pas à ce qu'un projet de médiation au niveau de la Cour d'appel réussisse, et ça a été un grand succès. Alors, je passe la parole à Louise Otis qui va vous présenter nos invités. Merci à tous et bonne conférence.
What's international mediation? International mediation is a mode of peaceful settlement of conflicts between states, community, groups, which involves direct participation by a country, organization, or individual intervening in their capacity of their neutral. Recognizing the need for a more professional approach to mediation, the United Nations has enhanced its readiness to implement and support mediation efforts. To achieve this goal, the United Nations has established a mediation support unit, what we call an MSU, and within the Policy and Mediation Division of the UN Department of Political Affairs. And within the unit, the creation of a standby team of mediation experts, those guys. Established in 2008, the standby team is a group of full-time mediation experts that can be rapidly deployed to provide technical advice to the United Nations officials and others leading mediation and conflict prevention efforts. Team members possess expertise in a wide range of issues that tend to arise in negotiations, this including constitution making, gender issues, natural resources, power sharing, and security arrangements. We have the privilege to welcome today three distinguished panelists who are all members of the United Nations standby team. They will discuss the role and function of peace mediation and, above all, reflect on some of their personal experiences. Michael Brown is a land and natural resource conflicts expert. He is a professor of practice in conflict mediation at the Institute for the Study of International Development here at McGill. John Packer is a constitutions and process design expert, and he is the director of Human Rights Research and Education Center, University of Ottawa. Marie-Joëlle Zahar is a power-sharing expert, and she's professor of political science and fellow at the Center for International Research and Studies at University of Montreal. Please welcome our panelists. At the end of the three presentations, please feel at ease to ask many questions, and this either in French or in English. I'm going to invite Mr. Brown. You're going to be the first. Good. 15 minutes, they say. As a former judge, usually I'm good as a timekeeper.
Merci beaucoup. Good afternoon. Conscious of the time, I'm going to jump right into it. And what I'm going to focus on is the focus on natural resources and land conflict issues in the context of peace mediation. And it's coming from the 2 years that I spent on the standby mediation team, specifically focused on that area. I'm going to start off with a few introductory words to kind of set the context around natural resource land mediation in the context of the standby team. And then I'm going to walk through a few examples from the field, and I'll finish off with some concluding observations. I guess setting the context, the natural resources and land brief, first off, it's a wide thematic focus on land issues, water, energy, and extractives, which includes oil and gas and mining issues. So it's it's a wide thematic area. I guess another comment is when we use the term mediation in the UN world, this is typically seen as alongside some other complementary peacemaking tools, particularly sort of the good offices role of the UN and the sort of the concept of dialogue, whether we're talking broader multi-stakeholder dialogue or some kind of national dialogue. So accordingly, these tools sometimes merge and overlap in their use, and also the use of the terminology is certainly not as rigorous as one would find in a domestic jurisdiction, as I would sort of use when I'm talking these issues in more of the Canadian context. With that in mind, I thought I'd just mention some of the sort of main categories of the roles played, and that is first around the planning, support, and coordination of a mediation process or a dialogue process. By that, I'm talking about senior level advice, thematic or strategic, regarding the planning or running of a mediation or dialogue process, the analysis that goes into understanding who, what issues, what's the proper way to address it, and also often the design of that kind of process, and facilitation as well often comes up. The second broad area is sort of conflict assessment, whether that is assessing the details of a particular dispute, particularly when we're talking the natural resources and land brief, or looking more broadly at the political context regarding a particular armed conflict. The third area that's particularly prevalent in the resources and land brief is systems design. Whether it's the designing of a dispute resolution or a mediation system to address large numbers of conflicts in a country or in a part of a country, or it's the design of a national dialogue system of some type, typically central level and trying to link that to local level. There's also some mediation training and mediation coaching plays in. Typically, it's senior UN staff, sometimes national counterparts, and sometimes civil society actors that are involved in a dispute dynamic. And then the last is we tend to do work on policy development and the generation of sort of guidance in this thematic area. And those who may have attended, we launched a publication in November on natural resources and land mediation. There we go. And that's an example of the kind of policy and guidance work that we do. Now, those roles in broad brush stroke can be played out in sort of the full spectrum of what I call the conflict stages. First, sort of the area of preventive diplomacy, that's sort of addressing disputes before they escalate. Secondly, in that category of sort of the range of peacemaking, which is where you're bringing the parties to an agreement and securing the peace, sort of the stuff that happens around the signing and the immediate follow-up of a peace agreement. And then thirdly, in that broad area of what we call post-conflict peace building, which includes sort of the immediate post-conflict reconstruction, kind of right after the crisis, and that merging into the longer-term building of institutions and more sustainable peace, ranging into longer-term development issues. I guess with that as broad entry point, I'm now going to talk through three specific examples from the field. I've chosen, they're a little varied, and each one, briefly, I'll talk about some elements of the context, the kind of engagement and role that was played, and some lessons that come out of it. First, transboundary water disputes in Central Asia, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. Context, complicated border lines cutting through and around areas of ethnic identity. Water is a very limited resource, series of reasons, aridity, unsustainable agricultural practices, and inheriting a water infrastructure from the Soviet era that just canals, ditches, dams, that is not working and leaking enormous quantities of water. So you have ongoing tension and conflict related to water issues at the local level in the cross-border area and limited engagement between the states at the central level. And there's a decision that the UN made to try and use local level entry point on these issues, given that the engagement was largely closed at the central level between the states. The engagement role. My support was focused on the UN country team, specifically the resident coordinator, senior person of the UN system in country, And also on the Department of Political Affairs, it has a regional center in the area that looks at regional issues and the binational relations between some of the countries. The work, local area, specifically worked with women's groups on both sides of the border, used mediation approaches to bring them together, to analyze the conflict dynamic in which they were working, to look at the options that they had collectively, and to make joint decisions. The focus was basically facilitating joint planning between them to come up with a collaborative approach to local water management at their level in the dynamic in which they were playing out. Then the focus on the central level was we then tried to work upwards. I designed with the UN system a binational strategy to coordinate through the central level mechanisms around water issues. Some observations coming out of that one. First, sort of underscoring that natural resources, although often a driver or cause of conflict, can also be used in a collaborative capacity as kind of a peace-building dimension, as something you can bring people together on to work collectively on. Secondly, use mediation, secondly is the multi-level aspect of resource disputes, which is unique, sort of a characteristic of resource disputes, choosing what level where you have an entry point to focus your engagement. And then third, an observation is that even though when you can have success at the local level, it doesn't always translate into success at the central level. I know that the UN's been trying, but it's been difficult to get traction at that central level. Second experience I'm going to share. Hydroelectric and mining conflicts in Guatemala. And actually the pattern I'm going to talk about is similar in many ways to the last 2 weeks I spent in Nepal looking at some similar issues, and I just got back from that. The context, Guatemalan context. Natural resources associated with high degrees of conflictivity, violence, human rights violations, and political instability. Before I went down, community leaders and security forces, in other words, state actors on both sides, had been killed around hydro and mining disputes at hydro and mining sites. The president had declared a state of national emergency, called in the army to one of the sites. And this dynamic reflects a series of structural and systemic problems of extremely weak governance, limited rule of law, unresolved land issues, and rampant corruption. Note, and I think many of you will be aware, the country had been through 35-year-long civil war, peace agreements in the mid-1990s, and these agreements contained specific provisions around indigenous issues, land, and natural resources. What I was involved with, the support was directed at the UN country team, also the government, and civil society actors. The request was to use mediation to resolve the disputes. It involved extensive engagement with a wide range of actors, but very early on, I had to clarify how mediation is not the right tool to solve structural and systemic problems at the level of individual projects. That said, there were other tools that can be used in that broader toolkit that I mentioned earlier. They don't necessarily solve things, but they can improve the dynamic where possible. Greater transparency, communication, and more constructive engagement, and negotiating certain issues to not resort to violence. Concretely, we set up some dialogues to get out of one particular crisis, used the president and the Archbishop of the Catholic Church as the key convening figures. The president alone most certainly would not have had the legitimacy required for the campesino and peasant side of the equation, so the fact that the Archbishop was part of that was fundamental and central. At the same time, I was clear that there was need to address those structural and systemic issues on land and resources. That said, I was not and am not naive that in the current context or at the context at the time that was likely to take place, but it was sort of clear to flag that. Lessons coming out of this. Mediation per se is not always the perfect tool, especially when you're looking at these structural and systemic issues at the level of individual projects. But there are related approaches that can still be used to reduce violence and save lives that are in the toolkit that we tend to consider when we're talking mediation in the international domain of peace building or peacemaking, that also that natural resources and land provisions, when they appear in the peace agreements, are often not implemented adequately or not implemented at all. Because in many ways, what we were looking at was a case of the non-implementation of the peace commitments from about 20 years earlier. The third that I'm going to run through is post-conflict land disputes, Sri Lanka. Very similar to some work I was doing in East Timor as well. Context. Conflict-affected provinces with thousands of post-conflict land disputes. Complex political environment with a very challenging set of relations between the United Nations and the government that many of you can imagine. And I was asked to develop a land dispute mediation system for the two conflict-affected provinces that had the thousands of disputes. The engagement role, the support was to the UN country team, the resident coordinator is the senior figure, and to the government of Sri Lanka, the Ministry of Justice, and the Ministry of Lands. The work involved, first off, a conflict assessment, truly getting a grip on the nature of the land disputes, the numbers, the types, which ones are suited to mediation and which ones are suited to other approaches of dispute resolution. It involved assessing the mediation capacities that exist in the country at the local level and at the national level and designing that integrated system. We ended up using community-based mediation, very traditional approaches, sort of more technical mediation, and arbitration and linked it to the courts. That was sort of, those are highlights of the integrated system. I was involved in preparing a draft bill for Parliament. I contributed some of the drafting to an early version that was jointly submitted by the two ministries mentioned, and also worked on the development of policies and a training program that the people who would act in the mediation system would be trained in the basics of mediation skills to run that kind of system. And the system, as it will be coming online, should be resolving a few thousand disputes over the next couple of years. That certainly is what I would expect it will be able to do. Importantly, it was explicitly, and this was a bit of not what was first desired, I had to be clear that certain disputes will not be addressed by that kind of system, particularly those where it's state against individuals and where you have dramatic power imbalances between the parties. And the lessons and observations there, this system's design reflects new directions in the field, particularly in resources and land conflicts, but in other areas of mediation as well, where we're looking, where disputes are numerous, have some similarities in nature, and are predictable that they will keep coming. Instead of just looking at individual disputes, we're increasingly looking at systems to address large numbers of disputes. And secondly, just the fundamental importance of knowing how to build on what already exists, and understanding and supporting local capacity where appropriate, where reasonable, where it's possible. I'm now going to end, conscious of time, on two main observations. The first is regarding natural resources and land when they're provisions in peace agreements, particularly that as we stand, they are inadequate and typically not being implemented. It seems to have been, we can see there's been an increased attention to these issues in peace agreements over like the last 25 years. Research at the UN Environment Program shows the first 10-year window of 25 years, about half the agreements included provisions on resources and land. The last 15 years, most of them do. That said, most of the provisions are vague and unclear on key issues related to resource governance and the use of resources to fund armed groups or conflict. Implementation, when it's taking place, is weak, and to be frank, it's woefully inadequate. And there are almost no monitoring, reporting, or feedback mechanisms on the implementation itself. This is particularly serious, given that resources and land are the underlying cause or driving factor in many of the armed conflicts in the world. And so one of these, and it has a fundamental, it's a fundamental issue that has the potential to undermine some of the peace mediation work that is taking place. Because we're working in places where we see that resources and land are drivers or causes, and yet we're not dealing with them adequately. I think in the thought of time, I'm going to leave it there and look forward to the questions and answers a little later. Thank you.
Your turn. Thank you, Michael. I was just stopping the alarm, you know.
Ah, wow. I'm pleased that I met the
20 seconds. Is that something?
Well, that's impressive. I hope I can follow suit. It's a great pleasure to be back here at McGill Law School. I think the last time I was here was about 20 years ago. At that time, on an invitation of René Prévost-Crowe, who's still here. And at that time, I was a staff member of the United Nations investigating gross violations of human rights in a number of countries at the time, in Iraq mainly. I think that's about the time we met. And full disclosure, I was working with his wife. That's a long story. great to hear that Ban Ki-moon is here and made a number of commitments, and the government of Canada has also said it's going to support work in this field. But the real story of work in this field is that it's little known, it's not very scientific, and for all the different commitments and rhetoric in support of it, it hasn't actually delivered in terms of much investment over the years. In fact, the standby team was a creation in the absence of an institutional arrangement at the United Nations. At that time, there was no mediation support unit, no policy and mediation department division. There was actually 20 years ago no Department of Political Affairs. So this is all something in a kind of invention. Let me also begin by saying that I increasingly believe the word mediation is the incorrect term for the work in this field. I'm very glad that this this session is titled Peace Mediation, because that modifier in terms of mediation is quite crucial. We are really risk of mistaking the similar for the same when we talk about mediation in terms of domestic mediation, or, for example, attached to a judicial process, and the kind of thing that happens, what we're talking about now. And I'll comment more about that in a moment. So I emphasize peace mediation as a distinct, not just variety of fruit, but probably a separate animal, completely different thing to mediation. My own background, I've had the honor and privilege to work now for about 25 years in, I counted up the other day because one of my children asked me, about 50 different countries of the world, but I'm not going to summarize that for you. I'll tell you right now, I'm working right now in Ukraine, Moldova. Next week I go, actually this coming weekend, I go to Georgia, specifically Abkhazia and Georgia, for that ongoing 20-year dispute. And I'm working with the Prince of Liechtenstein on a self-governance discussion amongst separatist or self-determination claims across Europe, within Europe, not outside Europe. Outside Europe is really complicated. Inside Europe is also complicated. That's what I'm doing now. Four situations I'll briefly comment on when I was on the standby team of mediation experts for 2 years, because I'll distinguish them in terms of character. So I was for 2 years, almost 2 years, I was the legal advisor to the UN special advisor to the Secretary General on Yemen. I spent about a third to half of my time in and out of Yemen, in Sana'a, working on a variety of things, but largely organizing and helping to deliver the National Dialogue Conference, the Comprehensive National Dialogue Conference, which was a total rethink on the state per se, because that was in contestation. I was also, I spent about 3-4 months, the only time in my life in this work that I was actually instructed to go to a world-class tourist resort. I spent 3 to 4 months in the Maldives, hardship post. I was the international legal advisor to a national commission of inquiry on the coup d'etat or purported coup d'etat. We determined there was no coup d'etat. That's very controversial in many places. So I had to shuttle between an island and a bureau for reviewing that. I worked on Chad, for example. You see, we talk about working on Chad as a problem. I went, in fact, to Jamana, the capital, for 3 weeks to work specifically on an extra-constitutional dialogue process established as a result of a peace agreement, because the institutional arrangements under that, in fact, dictatorship are dysfunctional. So you have the institutions of a parliament and a judiciary and all the rest of it, but it's in fact totally controlled by the president, and therefore the other communities and interests in the state have no real place to dialogue, so they established an extrajudicial one pursuant to an agreement which had exceeded its time agreement. We had to renegotiate to keep them from going back to war. That was a punctual engagement in a specific dispute situation 3 weeks in Chad. And I want to just tell you another situation, Lesotho, because I've never been to Lesotho. But I worked for some months on the situation of Lesotho. We call it a remote engagement with a number of people whom I'd never met. I met one of them subsequently, but I met a number of persons, the resident coordinator who was down there at the time, a peace and conflict advisor from UNDP, a number of political actors and so forth. There was a transition, a change of government, and the long-serving prime minister, it's a kingdom, was declaring that he would not step down even if he lost. So what do you do, right? I mean, is this an invitation for taking to arms or what? So we had to figure out a way in order to encourage the different parties to stay within some kind of peaceful process and not resort to arms, and to essentially persuade the prime minister to act in the better course of wisdom and peace and step aside, which did work. So I just wanted to share all those kind of situations. My title is Conflict and the Relevance of Norms. And the reason I add the word norms here is because this has contested itself in this field. So straightforward mainstream conflict resolution. If you read the literature, a number of the leading authors in the field will tell you that norms not only do not matter, but they are an obstacle to agreement. Even Roger Fisher, professor of law, author of Getting to Yes, would tell you anything is negotiable and you should not obstruct the possibilities of the parties reaching an agreement by consent, because their consent is what actually drives things, not only to agreement, but to its subsequent implementation. I want to tell you that's wrong, and that norms do matter, and that this is a crucial part of the development of this field. So I subtitled Towards Effective Peace Mediation. Quick little list of problems, and the first one, and the one that should be in glowing big lights, is violence. This is the main thing that distinguishes peace mediation from any other kind of mediation, is that we're talking about contexts where people are shooting, killing, stabbing brothers or to brothers, fathers to sons, or the reverse, and so forth and so on. Violence is the predominant feature of these situations, and it's really violence prevention, reduction, avoidance, diminution, whatever you want to say, that we're working towards. Peace, in what Johann Goltan calls the negative sense of peace, the absence of war, the absence of violence. His distinction is negative peace and positive peace being the idea of a resilient, self-generating society that can manage its disputes. So I also want to emphasize this is not necessarily resolving conflicts. It's taking the violence out of them. Many conflicts will simply persist. As we just heard from Michael, disputes over land, for example, are spatial disputes. And there are different ways you can cut a pie. I'll talk about cutting pies in a moment. But some of those disputes will not be resolved. You know, where a cemetery is that my great-grandfather is buried, it happens to be in the middle of a crucial route for development and so forth. We might not perfectly resolve that. So we have to find kind of essentially modus vivendi, I'll comment on in a moment, ways of living together and so forth. But it's really the issue is, can we get the violence out of this? And that's not only the issues, that's the process. People shooting at you. So in Yemen, I had a personal security detail. Guys who, by the way, were on drugs most of the time with automatic weapons outside my door. Really reassuring. And more than that, we didn't know who really, whose control they were under and so forth and so on. We can tell lots of anecdotes. So just to go through the list, violence is the predominant feature. These are essentially political legal contestations, often in flux, change. We're not sure what are the parameters, the basis, hard to even grasp. They typically feature complexity, conceptual complexity, really problems of options, the absence of options, insupportable options, and so forth. There are real complexities around who are the parties. So classic mediation, in terms of a dispute resolution model, would be two-party dispute, two protagonists, or a protagonist and respondent, and an intermediary, and then you have the list of kinds of forms of mediation and so forth, who between them would seek to resolve the matter, whether that's arbitration or conciliation or, there are different forms. But here, this is never the case in these places. There are not two parties with one clear. That's idealized and virtually never the case. You have multiple parties. You have factions within parties. You have personalities within, and you have all sorts of issues, really complex and compound. Organizational issues, and that's where I put the modus vivendi. Simply getting people together, even to meet. Meeting is problematical in a lot of different ways. So organizing in terms of process is hugely problematical. That's why design is often one of the words that now gains a lot of currency
How do you design a process that can organize a nonviolent way of dispute resolution? Real practical issues. Can I get access to people? What about the resources? So I mentioned a personal security detail. Who's paying for that? How do we select them? Do we vet them? I mean, there are many, many practical issues. And then there are the non-tangible but hugely important relational issues like trust, perspective. These actually are, how do we imagine? There's a very famous book written by, now his name escapes me, called About Imagining, Imaginations, Benedict Anderson. Imagine Communities, thank you. Where it's all about, you know, who are the Hungarians? Well, there's lots of Hungarians in Canada. Never met the Hungarians in Hungary, but never been to Hungary. But they imagine they are Hungarian. And then finally, the problem of transition. How do you move from a state of violence or conflict into a sustainable peace? I'm going to give you a quick example. I'll go through it fast, which is on an issue, linguistic diversity. Europe, very simple Europe. I'm not going to take India. I'm going to take the simple solution, simple one, Europe. 27, now 28, I think, countries, 24 official languages. Council of Europe has 47 countries. OSCE has 57 countries. The Federal Union of European Nationalities, that's express, acknowledged, represented nationalities, have 75 so-called stateless languages. We're not quite sure what that means, but, for example, Catalan. There's 10 million Catalan speakers, at least, spread over three countries, actually, Italy, Spain, and France, at least. But they are not formally recognized. They have no status in the European Union. 1 million Estonians do because they have a state. So Estonian is official language, but Catalan is not. Foreign languages, not recognized. Arabic, Turkish, Kurdish, Urdu, Tamil. Millions of speakers. Millions even in single countries, like Germany, not officially recognized. What about Romani? There's actually four principal versions of Romani, the language of the so-called gypsies or Tsigan and so forth. And then the distinctions between language and dialect. Wonderful joke I was taught by sociolinguists. I do a lot of work with linguists and sociolinguists. And they always say, well, you know, we actually don't know what we're talking about. And then they say, the joke is, what's the difference between a language and a dialect? You heard this one before? A language has an army and a navy. It's power. It's just power. So the problematic, if we look at the linguistic diversity in Europe, here's a map which tries to map it out. Here's the world, heck of a mess. So try and imagine now you have conflicts over the use of language. We have it in this country. And you officialize. That means you give power to a language, which decides things like who gets a job, whether you're able to actually present yourself in disputes, can you actually pursue the defense of your property? Depends what the language is. Hugely problematical issues, especially when you coincide these with issues of identity. You start to construct notions of nationality. Even race become very distinctive. Notions of ethnic. I was taught the other day just about the origin of the word barber, which apparently is a Greek word and comes from ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. They basically, the Greeks decided that they were the only civilized people and everyone else who they couldn't understand were barbar, barbarians. Very nice, neat way of othering. Other. How do you settle disputes where you've othered the others as below you, beneath you, possibly not even human? Issues of invention, reification. You know the Bosniaks in Bosnia-Herzegovina? They didn't exist 25 years ago. You had Muslims, who incidentally was not a religious designation in the former Yugoslavia. It was a nationality, for those who didn't know. They were descendants of Turks. So you had the bizarre notion, you had Catholic Muslims, because they intermarried and their mother was Catholic and they went to church, but they were Muslims. Not many, but they had them. So this kind of, and then they become reified. You start shooting someone because they're Bosniak? Pretty soon they say, well, I guess I am, and I better find the other ones to protect myself. So these kind of issues then lead us to questions of salience. What's the problem at core around which we might be able to find a new way of imagining or reframing the conflict and moving away from resort to violence, however generated? We have these metaphors, right? In Canada, the mosaic, the quilt, the salad bowl. And we have the classic melting pot. I mean, these are all ideas of what's a kind of conceptual way that we can live together with all our differences. I've got my son here today, and we were talking about, you know, who are you? Well, his mother is half Belgium, half French, but Belgian, you have to be more precise, Flemish. which part of, actually West Flanders. I mean, very complicated. I come from an English and an Irish background, and I discovered that part of my background is also actually Polish from three generations back. I mean, who are we? What are we? This kind of complexity, if you want to reduce it to identity, language issues, and so forth, this becomes very difficult to sort out. And these metaphors are reductionist. They help us a little bit conceptually. They don't actually tell us the answers, modus vivendi. How do we live together? We can imagine certain solutions. We can cut the pie. We can make a bigger pie. We can deepen the pie, enrichen the pie. This is kind of materialization. A little bit difficult on identity to do this. We can have bigger, smaller, and so forth. We can imagine different options. But there are limits, right? That we don't have unlimited resources. There are some ways that we can actually mix things together and some ways we cannot. So I want to skip just quickly to norms and conclude with the importance of these. So what are norms? And I mean them in the broadest sense, not just legal norms, all sorts of norms, cultural norms. Legal norms are of one category and maybe not the most important. Lots of people are motivated by things much more than legal. In fact, most people are. Religious norms, for example, cultural, social, and so forth. But norms are facts. Norms are also things that actually generate our ability to plan and live together and sort out what ought to be. And this kind of ought to be, for me and for you together, is quite crucial. Quick typology of them. There are kinds. There are variations. I can share this with you later. But this kind of, you can see immediately how this might be relevant for conflict resolution. To say that norms don't exist or are not material is to ignore that reality. In conclusion, it is crucial that we, Michael said, that we achieve an accurate conflict analysis, a whole methodology in this, understand, but including understanding the applicability, relevance of norms, including their possible dissonance. And then we need to construct a way of living together which includes a normative framework which is compelling. May not be law, may be compelling, a religious norm, for example. And understand that those dynamics then normatively may evolve. And that's a lot of this work. A lot of this work is essentially trying to find that way in which we can get a reframing, a shared understanding of living together, and then to institutionalize it and actually to do so in a way which removes violence as a legitimate resort. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Marie-Joëlle, your turn.
I wish I could say it was a mediation accident. It's not. I knew there was a strategy to going third, and that's why I used an abused alphabetical order, because both Michael and John, in different ways, have actually set the stage for, you know, looking more micro at what standby team members do and don't do. And let me start by pointing that although Michael talked about natural resources, John talked about mostly norms and, you know, the work he did on constitutional issues. Our titles are very misleading. During our time on the SBT, most of us worked not just on our portfolios, but also on a whole set of other things. And I was probably one of the, I don't know whether it's luckiest or least lucky, in the sense that I worked very little on power sharing issues, narrowly defined. I ended up working on security issues, disarmament, demobilization, non-state armed actors, local actors and their inclusion, the inclusion of women in processes. And in many ways, I think that highlights something that both of my colleagues have pointed but did not really, you know, belabor, which is the need for flexibility and versatility. I mean, in many ways, there is no one way to become a standby team expert. Now they call them advisors, and I'll get back to that. There are different ways to get there, and I think the richer your trajectory, the more varied your experiences, the better you are actually at understanding the need for framing and reframing and at having a broad, out-of-the-box kind of approach to the problems. There were eight of us. I don't think either one of you mentioned this. There were eight of us, often called mediation firefighters, because we were deployed in the places where the existing UN resources were at a loss as to what to do. And there were many more fires around than the 8 members of the team could put out. So in many ways, you could not be narrow. You had to be broad, and you had to be able to work not just autonomously, but also in collaboration with whatever resources existed on the ground, whether they were, you know, the not very reliable security detail that you needed to get from one point to the other, or, you know, the local actors, the archbishops, the presidents, and what have you. Having said that, I would like actually to turn to the roles that we've played on the standby team. And I want to focus on 3 roles in particular, although the list is much longer. I want to focus on the notion of us as mediation experts and what expertise means and does not mean in this context, as mediation advisors, and as mediators / facilitators. Inter alia, all these roles require access. Access to people, access to information, access to various locales where, you know, you need to go to talk to the relevant people. They also need tremendous amount of trust, especially when you're sent to the most difficult situations. It's very, very challenging to be parachuted in one of these one-off deployments that, the standby team had the secrets of. It's even worse to work remote access and not even know the people you're working with. And therefore, actually working to obtain the necessary requirements to secure access and gain trust was in many ways a very big part, I would say the biggest part of our challenge. And we had to negotiate and argue, including with the UN, with our own, shall I say, minders or whatever, at the mediation support unit to argue for the need to remain engaged beyond the one deployment, to remain engaged and go back to places so as to be able to follow up the work. And very often we failed. I think it's important to say that. The way in which people get dispatched to various places very much looks like a hospital emergency sorting room. And that means that there are important cases where you might have been able to do good that get left out, that no one pays attention to. I think it's important for all of you to realize that the standard tenure of a standby team member is 1 year. And in 1 year, unless you are John and you've worked with the UN for a long time before, you actually take half of your year to get to understand the UN bureaucracy and to get minimum access to your UN colleagues. So in many ways, the fact that we were an experiment of sorts, because all 3 of us were renewed on the team, was a very big part of our ability to do a little bit of good. Had we stayed only 1 year, which is the standard tenure, there was no way we would have been able to make even a small difference in the cases in which we've been involved. So let me go back to those 3 roles that I told you about. As experts, my colleagues have already kind of laid out what it means, providing lucid, informed analysis, developing options, designing systems. And in my case, when you're talking about power sharing, it's designing political systems that address some of these very difficult normative issues that John has actually laid out for us so brilliantly, as usual, that do not lend themselves to easy solutions. And what you try and do is think about what kind of institutions would be minimally acceptable to the various parties that are inclusive, that are transparent, that are accountable. And these are buzzwords, but that also address in one way or another the normative issues that divide and deeply divide people. And I think that we sometimes, sitting in the West, in our academic offices, and whatever, and looking at these problems, tend to belittle the extent to which the norms and the issues are deep and deeply felt. And so, yes, religion can be instrumentalized, but yes, religion is a very important marker for some people, and there are people who are willing to die for it, especially when, you know, you've been targeted for being Bosnian and told that you're Muslim, and all of a sudden it means something to you. It becomes an important part of your identity, and that means that the range of possibilities of how to live with others gets fundamentally changed, and you need to deal with that. It does not help to say, let's have liberal democracies, let's have a plural system. It helps really addressing these issues. So this is what, as experts, we are asked to do. And our expertise in no way prepares us to do this. Our academic training, and all three of us have, you know, law and political science degrees, what have you, gives us a small advantage. It allows us to do our own conflict analysis, which, by the way, is something that you seldom get when you're deployed, because no one at the UN has the time to sit and do a serious conflict analysis, map out who the actors are, what the various issues are, how they overlap, and so on and so forth. But there's a very different notion of expertise in academia and the requirements of mediation processes. So John was actually asked to work on Lesotho. I was shipped for my first deployment to Bangladesh, where we were supposed to avert what looked like an all-out war around elections that were deeply contested. And guess what? All I knew about Bangladesh was how it became independent and that it got flooded yearly. And as an academic, I think of expertise as spending years learning about a place. And that meant, and that is something that we all do, but I think, you know, it's worth talking about because it's the nitty-gritty of the job. That means that I basically went to my library and accessed it and downloaded everything I could about Bangladesh and started reading like my life depended on it to prepare for that mission. And that is something, I mean, Michael wrote, I think, his comments on a plane back from Nepal. He arrived today. And that is something that you do day in and day out. There's also tension between the true and tested solutions that, as experts, we've seen in the literature and analysis, and which our colleagues who work on this from a more theoretical point of view tell us can provide, you know, entry points into the management of violence and thinking out of the box. And let me give you a quick example. Now, on ceasefires, ceasefire experts have actually a long list of things that need to be done to be able to set up a ceasefire that is viable. But that requires the deployment of monitors, that requires being able to withdraw weapons at a certain range from, you know, demarcation lines. And then I'm asked to think about a ceasefire in Syria, where now, after 5.5, almost 6 years of conflict, there are 500 separate groups fighting on the ground. At the time, there were about 5,000. How do you even come to think about what a ceasefire would mean technically in Syria? And that's what I mean about thinking out of the box. The expertise that you actually develop in research never really mirrors the complexity of the real-life situations that you have to deal with. Also understanding the importance of norms and the fact that institutions are never neutral. That was a lesson I learned in Mali. As we were negotiating the latest attempt at a peace agreement in Mali, a big issue erupted over federalism. Of course, you know, I live in Canada, I've been Canadian for enough years to have become a true Canadian and think of federalism as, you know, an obvious solution to a lot of problems, particularly problems of diversity where you have, you know, communities that are regionally based. Yet the word federalism carries a very different meaning in that region of the world. First of all, because of the very deep French Republican tradition, where anything that devolves authority from a central state is considered as a real threat to the existence of the state. And second, because of neighboring experiences where federalism actually verified that concern because it led to the division of states into two, Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, what have you. And being able to understand that and actually step out of the expert position to see this from and with the eyes of the people in the region requires the kind of expertise that you don't learn in the classroom. What do we do as advisors? As advisors, we answer questions related to peace mediation processes, design of the processes. Things such as what to do, when to do something, and when not to do something. who and how needs to, who needs to be at the table, how do you think about the table? And let me give you very quick one-liners on each one of these. What to do? Maybe one of the most difficult questions is whether to mediate or not, because the UN has a tendency to want to be there to be part of the action. And when, with another colleague who's not here today, we were sent to the Ukraine and we came back to our political bosses and said, there's no room for the UN in this dispute, it was one of the most difficult things for the UN to hear, and they didn't want to hear it. And so being able to use your expertise and your knowledge to convince people about political truths that are difficult to accept, that the UN will not have access everywhere and that it may not be the best organization, the best intermediary in all places. When the ripeness of conflicts and other considerations that may kickstart a mediation process. Think about Syria today. Why do we all of a sudden have an interest in a Geneva 3? Is it because anything has changed on the ground? No. It is because of considerations having to do in great part with the aftermath of the Paris attacks and the need of the US and Russia after the Paris attacks to do something about what they consider to be at the source of terrorism and refugee flows. It was the day after the attacks that Kerry and Lavrov, meeting in Vienna, announced that there would be a ceasefire and a process. We've been working on this for 2.5 years, trying to convince them of the need to do this. Nothing to do with what was happening on the ground. Who and how do you set a table? Is there a point to bringing people into a room when you know they don't want to be in a room? After John left the standby team, I was dispatched to help the Yemen process. And in Geneva, the Yemeni parties did not want to sit in this, at the same table. So the UN had announced peace talks, and we ended up shuttling from one hotel to the other, trying to convince them and to talk to them and relay messages. So do you set a table? Do you announce a table and the expectations that come with, or do you actually think of mediation differently? Who sits at that table? Elites or civil society? Today, Syria's women are waging an international campaign to be part of the discussions, yet they're not invited. Political or armed actors? What do we do now in Syria when two of the main armed formations, al-Nusra and Daesh, will not be at the table because they're labeled terrorist groups, yet they're the ones that have the ability to spoil a peace process, right? Now, mediators, technically, that's not in our attributions. But the reality is, whether or not we've done it before and in different contexts, we're often thrust and put before the fact that we have to help facilitating and mediating. And that, in part, speaks to the fact that resources are stretched to the limit and that peace mediation is an afterthought. It has not really been streamlined, supported, or actually resourced adequately within the UN system. Now, mediation, I have to probably add, is not just in processes. We are also mediators very often between different parts of the UN system, not because they're fighting, because they sometimes fight, but also because they all want to work on these processes, but they work at different levels and they don't necessarily talk well to one another. When Michael and I went to the Central African Republic, our job was to start connecting the various dots. Had we not been there, there was no one who had enough time to actually stand back and think who's doing what and how does all of that actually fit in a coherent way. Before turning to my conclusions, I want to address something that neither of my two colleagues can really address, which is the gender dimension of working on the standby team. I'm sitting in this room. It's funny. It's the moot court. I haven't been here in a long while. I will take 2 minutes. Can I? Okay. And I look around me and I see all the portraits of many dead, not all, white males. In the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, it's the same thing. We had our meetings there when I was a student at McGill. It was the same. Well, mediation is still a man's world. And the reality of mediation, even in Europe and North America, but to a lesser extent here, is that, even when women are at the helm, the majority of the people sitting in a room are men. In Bangladesh, the two main leaders were women, but there were no other women around. Not everyone in that world is comfortable with women at the table. In fact, most are not. They question your expertise. They try and treat you like, you know, a token UN contribution to the debate on gender, as opposed to a bona fide expert. And there are therefore additional challenges for women, and I see a lot of women in the room, to be heard, seen, and respected for your own expertise. Now, the UN helps a bit, but not always. So they will allow me to put PhD on my card, unlike, you know, regular UN custom, to show that I actually have expertise. But they will not think about the composition of their own mediation teams, which in some places are exclusively male. In the Mali peace process, there were 10 different states and organizations involved, almost 200 mediators, that's the senior mediators and their teams, and only two women, myself and one person from the European Union. Believe me, it's not fun. Yet, you gotta do it, and you gotta have broad shoulders and be able to stand up high and speak with authority about your issues. Now, I want to raise two issues regarding the role of political mediation processes in helping to address acute political conflicts. And these will be my conclusion. First, the timing of mediation. Mostly after conflict has turned violent. Bangladesh was the one instance in which we did preventative mediation. Prevention is everywhere in all the reports that have evaluated UN performance in the last year, and there have been three major reports. All of them say the UN should do more about prevention. But prevention is not sexy. Prevention does not catch the attention because there are no headlines. Prevention is under-resourced, and as a result, prevention lags behind. One more obstacle, states continue to be extremely careful about their sovereignty, and unless, you know, it's turned very ugly, they will not give you access to go in and mediate. When in Bangladesh we went in, because Ban Ki-moon had actually been posted there for his first posting as a diplomat and therefore had a personal connection to the Prime Minister and her opponent, we were welcomed once. We were shut out after that. And in spite of the personal connection, the process was dead in the water. The second is something that actually John alluded to, and it's the tension between peace mediation as a solution to end the violence and the use of mediation as an opportunity for change and for significant change in societies. This is about broadening conversations, not just addressing the one theme that seems to be the most prominent, but really thinking about what are the other issues, making sure, for example, that land, even though it might not be an obvious one, gets addressed because it's about resources and power. Bringing new voices in. Part of the challenge of peace mediation is to make sure that you don't simply reify the elites and give them more power by giving them the only seats at the table. Yet they will fight tooth and nail. And we're not very good at thinking about interesting out-of-the-box approaches to inclusion of more actors. And then avoiding rigid solutions. Often, in an attempt to really end the violence, we create solutions that actually box actors and prevent progress. Bosnia is an example that took, 20 years before it was minimally acceptable to the EU, and I see that now it's going to join the EU, it started its process. But it's a country in which, to end the violence, we divided power in such narrow and closed ways that the people who wanted real change and democracy in that country had no way, had no hold, had nothing to hang on to be able to change the system. We actually ended up giving the worst offenders power and the lock over power. It is important, therefore, to actually think about all of these issues. In the interest of time, I had other things I wanted to raise. But thank you for your attention. Thank you to Luis for allowing me to.
So we have the chance here to have direct access to three international professional peace mediators. So please feel at ease to ask questions.
Is there a microphone? Yes. Yes? Questions? Yes, go on. So thank you all three for truly fascinating insights from your experience. I have a question to Madame Zahar. What you mentioned about preventive mediation, I'm very interested in your take on the reasons why that failed. Is it because unless there is sufficient conflict or evidence of people suffering or institutions suffering, that that those in power, that there's no support for mediation? Or are there reasons that would stand in the way of preventive mediation?
So, I mean, I think there are many reasons why preventive mediation is not as prevalent as it ought to be. The first has to do, from a UN perspective, with the limited resources at the UN. As John mentioned, the Department of Political Affairs is only 20 years young. But if you look at its budget, it pales in comparison with the budget of Global Affairs Canada. So you have the equivalent of a Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is completely under-resourced, and therefore there are very difficult choices that need to be made. So there's simply a matter of resources, financial and human. Many of the people who run desks don't even have the time to go and visit the countries that they're responsible for. So I think that's one thing. The other thing about prevention is that to be able to prevent, you need to very seriously follow developments. And yes, we do follow developments, but sometimes not as carefully. There are a number of reasons why. In the lead-up to the Rwanda, for example, genocide, a colleague, Michael Barnett, was actually sitting at the U.S. mission, and being a colleague, a political scientist interested in violence, after the genocide, he wrote a fascinating book about how come we didn't see it, including himself. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way in which there are bureaucratic blinkers, things you don't want to see, in part because you know you can't respond to them, and second, because of the way in which you interpret them in the frames that you put around events. I think there are other issues as well having to do with states not wanting to give you access. I mean, I mentioned it in Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is not a unique case by any stretch of the imagination. Today in Mali, there are serious concerns about the implementation of the peace agreement, yet the government presumes that because the war is over, it's their sovereignty that needs to actually be respected, and therefore they are increasingly narrowing the margin of maneuver of the UN in country. Of course, when violence erupts, it becomes much easier because the Security Council can seize itself of a matter, and therefore that gives the UN access. But I think there are other reasons as well. I'm sure I'm at least forgetting half a dozen, so I'd invite Michael and John to actually add if they want to add.
Thank you.
Some
comments?
Sure. So I ran out of time, but I had a few slides. So this is usually called preventive diplomacy, and there is only one institution in the world, two now, one that is dedicated full-time to the prevention of violence of this kind, which is the High Commission on National Minorities of the OSCE. I happened to be the legal advisor there for 5 years, and then I was the first director for 4 more years. For 9 years, I ran the office, and we worked in about 25, all across former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, but also places that people don't know we were involved in. Northern Ireland, a little bit in Spain, places people really have no idea, and I'll tell you right now one. For example, Greece, Greek-Turkish relations, which had to do with identity, passports, and so forth. Very, very quietly, very subtly. No one was getting shot at the time, but tensions were at different times mounting and so forth. So just a couple thoughts on this institution. It was set up in the context of the bloody dissolution of former Yugoslavia in 1992. So basically, the Europeans were suddenly scared. Okay, about a replication. They set something up to be an early warning mechanism, not an early action mechanism. But then, early warning would have just said to the states, hey, there's a problem. There were lots of problems. So there was an enlightened foreign minister in Sweden at the time who said, look, I don't actually know what the heck to do, and getting my colleagues to do so, I don't know, so you start working on it, please. And we simply did. Okay? But no other intergovernmental organization in the world has a similar institution. The thing closest to it is the UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, but this is extremely narrow subject matter and has been incredibly problematical to actualize. My analysis of why this is the case,
well, the near-term problems are there are no institutions. So we're not going to do it if we don't create the institution and don't invest the money and therefore the know-how and all the rest of it. But why we don't have the institutions, part of it is the jealousy of states over their own sovereignty. Part of it, I have to say, is it's not sexy. Doing things quietly, and I was involved in getting a new high commissioner a couple times, including a former foreign minister, I won't say who, of this country, and here's what they told us. If I get involved in quiet diplomacy, preventive diplomacy, my chances of success are small. My chances of failure are great. If I fail, I get blamed. If I succeed, no one cares. Who's interested in that job? We got turned down all over the place. We had to go around trying to find anyone to do the job. So that's a huge dilemma in it. In addition, I would just simply say the military-industrial complex. There's no money in it. There's big money in the perpetuation of violence.
The main points have been covered there clearly. I tend to think it's the issue of it's not in a lot of people's interest to admit there are conflicts in a lot of places. Economic dimensions, the political realities of the leaders, the elites in any particular country, the broad funding issues, it just isn't as sexy as other work where people want to put in their monies. And that sort of relates to there aren't many institutions and not a lot of staffing prioritizing the area. Other issues at play too, but those are real highlights to what's going on.
As member of the standby team, do you have access to the top level of countries, president of countries, minister? Do you have access to them? How much is your influence? Because now I'm going to tell you. You have these high-profile mediators called Holbrook, General Mitchell, Tony Blair, Kofi Annan, Brahimi. They're all in newspaper. We don't see your name in newspaper. Tell us. This I want to tell you. You do the job, and they are not mediators. Who trained these guys?
I'll take it first. Yeah, I think you're highlighting one of the central issues as to why the standby team was first set up. A lot of the senior level UN mediators actually are there primarily because of gravitas, and they don't have experience in mediation. So what you have, and I think all of us have realized, is a lot of what takes place under the heading of mediation in the UN system is some of it's pretty unsophisticated mediation. To be very clear, especially when one is coming from a mediation background where one sees it and understands the approaches, the techniques, and the tools that are used, that tends to be done without the rigor that one would expect
so
from coming from other backgrounds.
So it's reputation only.
Well, there's an element of that. And there are some reasons, sort of in the level of high politics, gravitas matters.
Yes.
But I think the other thing is a lot of the support, and part of the reason of the mediation team was put up was to provide technical support, to up the skill level, to up the technical level of the UN system in terms of mediation. In terms of access, it very much depends on the country and on the context. I think ranging from what we've been speaking about, access is sometimes generated through the mechanisms in New York, through the different levers and access points that the UN system has, often leveraged through individuals who have personal levels of access, and some we've talked about in the case of Bangladesh. In other countries, some of the access is generated by the individual team members and the level of knowledge and reputation we may have in different countries. I know in some countries that are less high profile on the mediation peace-building scheme, I was talking about the case of Guatemala, for instance, it's not at the high profile level right now because the peace agreement was 20 years ago and no one really wants to talk about the fact that it didn't achieve a lot of things, and that's what we're seeing now with the unfulfillment of it. But some of the access we get are by the individuals who have a history, who have a knowledge, and can access people that way.
Yes. Maybe I'll add one thing, which is...
Because I remember you worked with Holbrook.
That was another lifetime. yeah. No, but more generally, I mean, to add to what Michael said, in a lot of the top international mediators... are selected in great part because of their diplomatic credentials and their gravitas. But that was also one of the reasons why the Mediation Support Unit was trained. Part of its objectives is actually to help train mediators. And they do, and I mean all of us in our different capacities have actually done trainings for high-level mediators. There is, however, a catch. High-level mediators tend to be very busy people,
And they tend to be also people whose pride is such that they don't like the idea of admitting that they don't know. So the most efficient trainings, in my experience, have been these repeated engagements where you work alongside a mediator, John in Yemen, myself in some of the countries, where basically you develop a relationship with the top mediator and you help them without actually telling them you're doing so.
So that was very nicely put, but I'll give you a couple...
Ego.
Oh, ego's huge. A couple quick distinctions. First of all, there's a distinction generally now made between mediation, as I say, I don't think it's the right word, and mediation support. And so what we generally do is what's broadly called the support element. And sometimes, as Marie-Joëlle said, we are sometimes facilitating directly, sometimes literally mediating very specific issues of access or whatever. So there's a whole gradation of this. But to give you a quick example, Matti Ahtisaari, Nobel Prize winner, I work with him in a number of places, he was a school teacher. He got in development assistance. He became the head of FINITA, the Finnish Development Agency. The way that international relations works, as a result of that, in Finland contributing money, he got a position in the UN. He got to know Kofi Annan personally when Kofi Annan was in human resources. It was the background Kofi Annan, recruited directly as a staff member from Ghana out of a Minnesota college, worked his way up. And there's funny coincidences here. Matti Ahtisaari has never taken a course in his life on anything to do with mediation or even conflict, as far as I know. And he got involved as a special envoy, the way these things work, men behind closed doors. That's how it used to be. It's still close to that. And was sent down to Namibia, I think it was, and happened to be present at the time and took a few steps where things worked out. Hallelujah. Suddenly, Matti Ahtisaari is a rainmaker. Things work out. He's not like you mentioned Holbrooke, who comes with something else, which is USA behind you. There are mediators and there are mediators. But I want to just say that this field is, as I mentioned, not very scientific. It's evolving. And the idea of what they actually do, and particularly in the context of quiet diplomacy, is a kind of mystery, a black box that they have an interest in perpetuating. They don't actually like it to be revealed, because to be under scrutiny about what's actually happened, not happened, and so forth, is a huge issue. Last thing I'll just say is that we have had the opportunity at working different levels. It depends on the country and the situation. But for example, sometimes it's actually advantageous to the mediator not to be involved directly because he wants dissociability. He wants deniability. Okay? Part of protecting his status and part of our interest in protecting his status, I say his because it's almost always men, is that we may need to protect him. I'll give you a quick example. In the context of Latvia after the Cold War and its restoration of sovereignty, big issue around language issues, the country adopted an exclusionary Latvian language law, not allowing minorities to speak the language and so forth. This was a huge issue and could have been very explosive. We got involved, we set a number of comments and advice on the law. If the High Commissioner, then a former foreign minister, had gone, this would have been very public. He could not have denied he came. There was a new president, former woman from Montreal, University of Montreal, Professor Vaira Fibrica, who became president. She had been president for a week. She gets handed the new law she's supposed to promulgate. He wrote a letter to her in confidence saying, please don't promulgate it. This is explosive. She said, I don't know what to do with this. She was the head of the World Association of Latvians, and more than that, a philologist. And you're telling her, don't do something that's existential for the country. And he couldn't really come, so he sent me. So I went, and I met with her for an afternoon. We went through the law point by point directly, and I basically gave her arguments point by point about what she could say and how she could present it to equip her to do the right thing, which was to return the law to the parliament with changes. But in that case, the mediator could not have done it, actually.
I wanted to ask him, some of you have spoken about how in some cases, I believe it was you who spoke about, in the case of Bosnia, the mediation of the solution that was sort of proposed and ended up actually having some deleterious ramifications. I just wanted to know, when you're working as a mediator in some circumstances, I can only imagine that you would be sometimes mediating over the most urgent issue, which is the violence, at the expense of dealing with other issues, and sometimes even at the negative expense of making some issues worse by just really focusing on getting rid of the violence. I just want to know how is that for you to deal with, and the feeling that you might be doing some short-term good for some long-term problems that will only make the situation worse going down the road. So I just want to know about your own mental, how do you get yourself to think that you're still doing good work, but also what do you think about that?
I think it's a very important question and a difficult one. As experts, I'd like to think that the fact that we're not the ones deciding helps. But I also think that, and I know for a fact, because I've had discussions with these two and others as well, I know for a fact that there have been times when we've actually had to differ with the senior decision makers and to actually lay out arguments as to why there is a concern about short-term goods versus long-term ills. The other thing that we do systematically, and of course, again, because the decision is not ours to make, is that most of us have to write reports at the end of our missions to the UN Department of Political Affairs. And these reports go up to the highest chain. And in our reports, we need to be very clear about these issues and to flag them to the UN. Now, I know for a fact, in my case, that I've often been told my reports are undiplomatic. And I've refused to actually, you know, smooth the corners because I find that I have an ethical obligation. I've also been very blunt in the interview that I that we all actually went through before being hired to say that if at one point there was an ethical problem that I thought was important enough, I would prefer to resign. And it came close in one of my engagements, and I had a very serious discussion with the UN about that. That's how I deal with it, but I'm not really sure that there is one standard way, so I'd be interested in hearing what others have done.
Part of your question goes to the heart of some of the challenges in the thematic area of resources and land in particular, which, although, as you've heard, all of us tend to cover a wide range of issues, probably on the team I stuck most closely to the resources and land issue. And one of the key parts of the dynamic that's playing out is in most of the conflicts, and as I mentioned earlier, land is typically driving or a root cause of a lot of the armed conflicts that are taking place. Yet, it typically is not the first priority issue when the peace negotiations take place. The focus is on security, the focus is on some human rights issues, the disarmament of the rebel groups. In many ways, very understandable. But what we're seeing is what I was sort of alluding to in my presentation is the fact that some of these root cause issues are not getting proper attention. It's relatively superficial attention that's taking place. The mechanisms are not being put in place to implement or follow up on those. And as a result, we are seeing a repeated number of situations where the root cause issues are not being addressed. And I'm feeling quite confident one can say in 5 to 10 years' time in a number of these situations, we will be seeing the conflict dynamic come back forward because we haven't addressed some of those root cause issues. In terms of how one deals with it, I'm thinking of where Marie-Joëlle and I spent, we did, I think, two missions together in the Central African Republic, where we were there on a brief related to national dialogue and reconciliation. And yet, on the plane out from Montreal, we spent our time sort of looking at things, and it was very clear the critical role that resources and land issues had played. And simply, we beat the drum of the importance of that issue consistently and constantly. Then when we went on our times, when we left country and went back to New York, we spoke to all of the critical actors that we could inside the UN system, emphasizing the importance of it. Direct cause-effect, I don't know, but when the new mission of the UN was put in place, there were specific provisions in terms of the mandate to look at resources and funding rebel groups. Adequate? No. And that perhaps goes to the sort of the personal dimension of dealing with this kind of work, is I think one has to have certain personality profiles help when you deal with these kind of complicated and challenging issues. And I sort of consider a kind of realistic optimism helps out, but that's just a personal way of trying to view it and not get too overwhelmed sometimes.
I'll just quickly add a couple of things. On the, it is a big important question. So not to be flippant, but on the personal level and personal context, this is quite important. And the kind of situations, I want to go back to violence. You're talking about parties who, the very fact they may meet with you might risk their lives. And so I don't say that as a theoretical matter. I have met with people who were killed subsequently. So this is unfortunate. And I have not dealt with that lightly. But how do I deal with that personally? I'm 55 years old and I still bite my fingernails. There's a hard reality about the social psychology of this and the individual psychology. Michael talks about personality in certain contexts, how you deal under extreme pressure with that context. Now, what do you do in terms of answering your question? There has been in the United Nations and internationally a progression towards a normative hierarchy. In the humanitarian field, they now talk about life-saving imperative as the normative basis to decide, for example, do we provide water first, shelter, what do we do? And there is this idea, and the humanitarian organizations have worked it out, but in this field, we haven't much talked about it. But I would say that the fundamental imperative, and that's why there's a certain logic that ceasefire generally precedes peace agreement, you don't have the inverse, is that you do need to stop people killing, and that's a really important thing, because while people are killing, all sorts of other things are not possible, the dynamics and so forth. So there is this argument. But technically, then, there are some other questions. So one of the techniques in a kind of process is what roughly I would call buying time. Can you get a relationship established through which a process can be established and rooted, which might transform the dynamics? Now, we use this word transition lightly. I put it up there. We haven't deconstructed it. But part of it may be buying time for other processes to take shape, for institutions to be developed. Now, one thing on constitutions, in terms of constitution design, if you look at constitutions, a number of constitutions in these cases are peace agreements, de facto. De jure, you could say, too. But what I want to say is that if you look now empirically at constitutions, increasingly constitutions of this character include an element within the constitution called transitional arrangements and sometimes review mechanisms. I'm a big advocate of this. In many places I've been involved, I've helped put them in. And these are to allow, to avoid an all-or-nothing agreement where this is done and we have no way to change it because that's the constitution. So we're buying time. We're allowing for there to be steps that we know need to be taken down the road, but in the meantime, we stop the killing, we move to another process, and even we will put a process in called a review process. So we'll say, you know what, in 10 years, a step-by-step implementation.
So I've noticed when we had a conference about national resources mediation, and I gave a good example that the four phase, preparedness and pre-mediation and all that steps, now we have exactly the same steps in national mediation. So there's not a lot of difference these days except violence. But, you know, we do family mediation. Go on, Ron.
Thank you. I want to follow up on something that Michael Brown said in passing about mediation not really working between two parties that are unequal in power. I'm assuming the state and a minority group that are in conflict. Because I'm aware, I may understand that there are mediation techniques that can deal with parties that are unequal in power. So I'm wondering why, in peace mediation, this might be an important factor that would preclude any kind of intervention. If I had to offer an answer myself, I would say it has to do, again, with states and their assertions of sovereignty and of power on the situation. But I